Okay, everyone, thank you so much. Welcome to the Tuesday, August 24th meeting of the Arroyo Grande City Council. Can we get a roll call, please?
Councilmember George?
Here.
Councilmember Storton?
Here.
Councilmember Barnidge?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
Here.
Mayor Ray Russom?
Here. Would you please silently join me in the flag salute? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. At this time, I'd like to go ahead and open up public comment on our closed session items, since this is the special part of our meeting today. So AGP, let's turn it over to you.
Madam Mayor, there are no members of the public in attendance.
Okay, thank you. So I will close public comment and ask our city attorney to announce the closed session.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. The council will now adjourn to closed session for a conference with the real property negotiators pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.8. The property is Hardin Street at North Mason Street. The agency negotiators are Whitney McDonald, City Manager, and Bill Robeson, Assistant City Manager, Public Works Director. And on the other negotiating parties are Ty Green on behalf of Alex Carapetti and Christiane Schmidt.
Thank you very much. So at this time, we will adjourn to special meeting and we will reconvene to open session at this Zoom link at 6 p.m. We'll see you all in just a few. Thank you. Jessica, are we ready?
Madam Mayor, AGP is broadcasting and recording.
Thank you.
All right, excellent. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. We are back from our special session at 5 o'clock. This is the August 24th, 2021 meeting of the Arroyo Grande City Council. Can we get a roll call again, please?
Councilmember George?
Here.
Councilmember Storton?
Here.
Councilmember Barnidge? You're on mute. I can see Councilmember Barnidge is here. Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
Here.
Mayor Ray Russom?
Here. Would you please silently join me in a moment of reflection? Thank you. And will you also please join me silently in the flag salute?
So I can't even
I pledge allegiance to the flag.
I don't know.
Excuse me. Oh, Kristen, I hear you. I'm going to restart the flag salute, okay? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It sounds like Councilmember Barnidge's audio is working now, so that's good. So we've got everybody here and ready for item 5, agenda review. Is there anyone who wants to move things around, or shall we just proceed as published? All right, we will proceed as published. Then I will ask our city attorney to announce our closed session.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. The council just held a closed session for a conference with its real property negotiators pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.8. There is no reportable action.
Thank you very much. And we have no ordinances tonight, so we'll be skipping 5B, and that takes us straight to special presentations. This first one is our standing item, the update regarding countywide COVID-19 efforts, and we'll turn it over to City Manager McDonald.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. I guess maybe out of the gate, our first update related to COVID this evening is, as everyone can see and is here, we made the decision to resume our meetings by Zoom as opposed to in person, really because of what we're seeing locally with our uptick in cases, largely driven by the Delta variant. We're seeing that, you know, with a lot of our local agencies are taking the same step, making the same move to go back to Zoom or provide, you know, a more remote version for their meetings just to address the surge that's happening currently. And so the news is really not great right now. Dr. Borenstein's update, or the update we received from the county just a little bit ago, about an hour ago, reported 5 additional deaths, as well as 460 new cases since Friday. We'll get into some more of those statistics in a little bit. Also, just wanted to touch on face mask requirements, as those are kind of shifting a little bit in terms of what we're hearing from our health officials and their strong recommendations. So our local public health officer, Dr. Borenstein, issued really some guidance, strongly urging everyone to wear masks while indoors, regardless of vaccination status. And urging businesses to adopt universal masking requirements indoors. Again, for everyone, regardless of vaccine status, for all employees and patrons. And so I don't know if anyone's noticed, you know, out and about more mask wearing while indoors. They are also recommending that for outdoors, in areas of high transmission of the virus, that if you are in a highly crowded area and you're outdoors, they're also recommending masks in those situations, but not in other ones. So again, CDC guidance, as we talked about a few weeks ago, is it was so nice to have a moment to be able to have our meetings in person. We got 2 in, so that was better than none, I think. So our first meeting in July, we talked a little bit about the CDC's mask guidance, which suggested masks indoors for anyone, regardless of vaccination status, in areas of substantial or high transmission. At that time, we were in the moderate transmission category. We are now in the high transmission category, but we are, I guess, in good company. Most of the country is in the same place. And I thought I might take some time tonight to kind of show some of the data that's out there and some of the information that's available publicly from our various agencies, both from the CDC, as well as from our local county health office. And so if you'll bear with me, I'd like to go ahead and share my screen a little bit. So just to touch on that map from the CDC identifying places of high transmissibility. Here we are. So pretty much the whole country is red, which is not good. And so we aren't alone. This is what they're showing for the rest of the country currently. And this is updated as of yesterday. So I'm not sure if I switch between my tabs here. I'm not certain if you will come with me. So I apologize for the flashing back and forth. If that happens too much, feel free to certainly let me know it's too much. But I thought this could be helpful because I found it to be helpful for myself in kind of thinking about what's going on locally as well as in our country and sort of why we're all taking the steps we're taking at this point in time. So the CDC, that large red map, you can drill down into by county. And so this is what they show for information about our county. Interestingly, they go into some data about our vaccination status. Their information is a little different from the county's. So I'm not totally certain about why their numbers are lower than ours. So they are showing that our county is roughly in the area of 57% of our total population being fully vaccinated at this point in time. And then they provide some additional information about our case rates, although it doesn't look like they're quite as updated for August as we will see from some of the county information. So we're seeing again, you know, these spikes, the upticks aren't fun for anyone, I think. So when we look at our the transmissibility and transmission rates within our own county, there's more information available to us through our own readyslow.org website. So we can go to, again, those highlights. Currently, the county is reporting 1,538 active cases. And by comparison, back at the beginning of July, we had 100. So that just gives you an idea of quite the uptick in our current active cases just within the last 2 months. And I think trying to help explain why we're taking the steps we're taking at this point in time to try to just wait out this period, really as the Delta variant kind of sweeps through. The county does not trace, they don't do the testing, the variant testing on every COVID test. It's only a small percentage, I think, that they run that level of testing to figure out, you know, which variant or category it lives in. But I believe there have been days and at least periods of time recently where all of the tests that they have looked at for that DNA strain have been Delta variant. So we are seeing that being really quite a cause for what's occurring locally. And then finally, I'll just kind of touch on, kind of scroll through a little bit of what additional information is available on the county's website. I'm not sure why, or I suppose 1483 at-home cases as well as the hospitalized helps us get up to that higher 1,538 active cases. We have 16 people in the ICU locally as well. And there is some information about variants, and it does explain they don't test all of them. And I believe this is all data from the state as opposed to locally. But it is kind of interesting showing you the progression of the different variants over time, as well as really the dent that vaccinations have been making in case rates as well as hospitalization rates. So it's showing us that that of those who have, since January, of those who have contracted COVID, 98.5% of them have not been fully vaccinated. The percentage goes up for those folks who have unfortunately passed away due to COVID. Hospitalization rates are also much higher for those who are not vaccinated as well. So we can look through some of this additional data on, again, why our cases are going, why we're looking, why there's more concern, and why folks are taking steps to make changes to some of their plans, because our case rates really have been going quite up. So if anybody's curious, they look at new cases by month, by age. So again, we're looking at, we're basically looking at what we were like at the end of January. Hopefully, I mean, maybe this just last week, new daily cases is indicating maybe we're getting better. And we're kind of coming out of that surge, but we will see. That's not based on health information from, you know, our health officer. It's just looking at basic graphs. So if anybody's wants to look more, there's a lot of helpful information there. I mostly wanted to highlight that because it really is a growing concern. And I think that people, you'll hear their events are being canceled, and there's just extra concern around it. And this is part of why we've taken the step that we did to resume our meetings this way in Zoom. Finally, wanted to highlight that the county is still offering $25 gift cards for anybody. If you go get vaccinated through the county health clinics this month through the end of August, I'm sure everybody's known and seen that the Pfizer vaccine received full clearance from the FDA yesterday. And finally, just wanted to kind of let everyone know that from an operational standpoint, what we see is a significant impact to staffing, or at least the potential for that impact on staffing, if a case occurs within our staff. The rules require that if there's direct contact, and that term direct contact is defined. So if you have somebody who's been within 6 feet of someone else for more than 15 minutes at work, if they are not vaccinated, we are required to send them home and have them tested. And actually, they're supposed to quarantine for 10 days. So you could imagine the impact that one positive case can have on our staff at any given time. And especially given kind of how small we are already, that could be potentially quite challenging for us. If the person that you maybe was in direct contact with is vaccinated, they are not required to leave to be tested or to quarantine. Of course, we fully support anybody getting tests. If anyone is exhibiting symptoms, they are required to stay home, of course, even if they're vaccinated. But again, that vaccination status makes a big difference for us in terms of how we deal with a positive case. So just wanted to let everyone know sort of that's where we're at. It's not great news. And I think it's discouraging, but I think at least we do see with the vaccinations are being effective in slowing, you know, the impact of the virus. We're just trying to help get the word out, help motivate people to take that next step, to go ahead and get vaccinated to help us continue moving forward. So just wanted to let everyone know about that. And of course, if you have any questions, feel free to jump in.
All right, let's check in with the council and see if anyone has questions. Councilmember Barnage?
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to let people know, because it's just about the testing process. My parents came down. They were both sick a couple weeks ago, and so we took them over to the San Luis Vets Hall to be tested. And it was kind of when the surge was just starting to happen, and there were quite a few people out front. It was pretty crowded, but they were really in and out within about 10 minutes, got their test results back in about a day. Now I hear it's about 2 days. They were both negative, but so there is just the garden variety sickness going around as well. Also, what I thought I would mention is there were a lot of people there that had never been tested through LHI, who's the contractor that's performing the test. And they were all kind of sitting out front on their smartphones registering, and it looked like they were registering in I know that website was a little bit wonky in the beginning, but it took them maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes at most to register, and then they took them right in as long as they had that little ID, because if we've been tested, you have that LHI ID. So if anyone needs to be tested, a lot of people didn't have appointments. A lot of people didn't have tests ever performed by that lab. And so just go over to the Vets Hall. I don't know the hours by heart in San Luis Obispo. And seemingly, if you have a smartphone, you can get right in and get tested. So they made it, the county was making it pretty easy as far as I could tell. So those are just helpful comments, hopefully, if anybody needs to be tested. Thank you.
Thanks. Councilmember Storton, any questions?
I have none, but thank you, Whitney, for the detailed information. Obviously, getting vaccinated is extremely important.
Councilmember George?
I have none, thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
No questions, thank you.
All right, thank you so much. We'll go ahead and open it up to public comment and see if anyone has comment on this item, item 6A. This is the COVID-19 regular update. I'll go ahead and turn it over to AGP.
If any member of the public would like to speak on this item, please raise your hand now. Madam Mayor, there are no raised hands.
Okay, thank you. So I will close public comment, and this will take us ahead to item 6B. This is City Manager Communications.
Thank you. So I thought I would just sort of continue that, you know, that train of not so much fun and make the announcements that I think some have heard already related to COVID, which is that the Harvest Festival announced last week that they would be, the committee decided to cancel the Harvest Festival for this upcoming September. I know a lot of people are disappointed, and I believe that the concern, I think, was that the event is really catered to children, particularly those under 12, and given that they are not able to be vaccinated, just a concern out of safety to, given what's going on. That was, I'm sure it was a difficult decision, but we very much look forward to next year's festival. I'm sure between now and then, we'll all have run away with all kinds of wonderful ideas for how we're going to make next year's even better and more fantastic. So looking forward to that. Along those same lines, you may have noticed there is a supplemental memo related to the Beer Feast temporary use permit item. I know that is coming up on our consent agenda, but it just feels like it's quite similar to the announcement related to the Harvest Festival. The decision was made by that applicant similarly to not move forward with the Beer Feast as well, which was planned for the beginning of October. So hopefully we'll just need to hunker down a little bit longer to get through this time frame and be able to resume our normal activities next year. Kind of switching gears, we are moving forward with our districting process, and we'll be holding our first workshop and are planning to hold our first workshop on September 18th, which is a Saturday between 10 to 12. Another workshop has been penciled in for October 28th between 6 and 8 p.m. Both of those are currently, we're currently thinking possibly a hybrid, but we of course will, in terms of, you know, possibly, you know, we'll take a look. September 18th might be difficult for having an in-person gathering, but we're going to try to just see what's going on locally. And by hybrid, I meant having a Zoom option or a remote option available for anyone who would like to participate that way, as well as an in-person option. We are also planning to send both a flyer and a paper map to mailboxes and with utility bills in the coming weeks. So we are planning to get that process up and running, and you'll be seeing that coming pretty soon. We have received a few maps already, so it's exciting that at least some people know what's going on there and have used some creativity and given us some great ideas to start working from. Just also highlighting a few items that will be coming forward to your council in the coming month or two. Of course, our next meeting on September 14th, we are planning to have our Central Coast Blue discussion. We had hoped to have that this evening, but a few things kind of got in the way and we needed to push that back to September 14th. So we are looking forward to bringing that forward, talking about really a new framework for potentially moving forward with that. Along with a preliminary discussion of other water supply alternatives. So that's still slated for September 14th. Going along the water train, we are also going to be talking on the 28th of September about potentially enacting a stage one water shortage emergency or proposing adoption of a water shortage declaration. So we are looking at September 28th. That's a public hearing process, so notice will be sent out ahead of time for that. Our water and sewer rate study is underway, and so we will be bringing that forward as well, either late September, early October. And then shifting gears into community development items, the Planning Commission on August 17th held a meeting and has made a recommendation to council for adoption of amendments to the city's ADU ordinance. So we will be bringing that forward soon, potentially on September 14th as well. So looking forward to bringing that forward for consideration by council. along with a discussion of parklets, which is not likely to be on the 14th, but will be soon after that. So just wanted to let everybody know those are some of the things coming forward. And with that, that's all I have for my updates.
Thank you very much. Again, let's check in with council and see if anybody has questions. Council Member Storton?
I have none. Thank you.
Council Member George?
Yes, thank you for that, Whitney. That was a lot of information you packed in. Just a quick question about the maps that we got in. The last meeting we had 2 weeks ago, we had received two maps. Do you know how many we have now?
That is a good question. I think, I don't know if maybe Jessica can provide an update. I'm not sure if we've received more.
I have three.
Yay, one more. And then I just recalled when we were going through the Briscoe project, Briscoe had its own dedicated email that people could send emails to. Is there a need to do that for this districting process? Like, would that be helpful? Just food for thought.
I think, Jessica, I can't remember. I know we have been identifying an email address on the information we've, and it's on the website, but I can't recall if it's specific to districting.
It's not specific. It's the public comment at arroyogrande.org. Since we widely advertise that email address, figured that was an easy one for people to remember, and we check it daily. So I think it's just as useful.
Thank you. Those were my only questions.
All right, and Councilmember Barnidge, did I go to you already? Okay, and Mayor Pro Tem Paulding, any questions?
Just one question actually on the districting, and I do appreciate the comprehensive staff report. A member of the public had questioned whether the data that is currently populated in the online tool is preliminary 2020 census data or if it's data from 2010. It is the preliminary 2020 data, correct?
That is correct. That's okay. Right.
Thank you. Those are all my questions, Mayor.
Okay, and I have a question about the stage one thing, but I'm gonna ask that later on the consent agenda item. So I'm gonna hold back. So let's go ahead and open up public comment. So if you would like to comment on any of the city manager's items that she just reported, so this is item 6B, go ahead and let AGP know. So I will turn it over to AGP.
I see one speaker, Jeff Edwards. If anyone else would like to comment, please raise your hand. Jeff, you are allowed to talk. Please unmute your microphone.
Thank you. I raised my hand inadvertently. I really have comments for the next agenda item, general public comment. Thank you.
Madam Mayor, there are no other comments.
And I'll check in with our city clerk to make sure we got nothing written. Sorry, I forgot to do that on the last item.
That's okay. I would have jumped in. There are no written public comments.
All right. Thank you. This takes us to item 6C. This is an honorary proclamation declaring September 17th through 23rd, 2021 as Constitution Week. And we have Leslie Lechner here to receive this proclamation. So if you could, AGP, bring her into the panel. And I'll go ahead and begin to read the proclamation. Whereas September 17th, 2021 marks the 234th anniversary of the drafting of the Constitution of the United States of America by the Constitutional Convention, and whereas it is fitting and proper to officially recognize this important document and the anniversary of its creation and the patriotic celebrations which will commemorate the occasion, and whereas Public Law 915 guarantees the issuing of a proclamation each year by the President of the United States of America designating September 17th through 23rd as Constitution Week. Now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Karen Ray Russom, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, do hereby proclaim September 17th through 23rd, 2021 as Constitution Week in the City of Arroyo Grande. So at this time, I'd like to invite Leslie to say a few words, and especially about what this is going to be used for. It's pretty neat.
Wonderful. Mayor Russell and council members, our 90-member La Cuesta Daughters of American Revolution sincerely thank you for making this proclamation. And I hope each of you will be able to stop by the San Luis Obispo Library lobby to see it on display, along with Constitution Week display, which discusses how we are acknowledging the framing of the Constitution. So we greatly appreciate that. And as a nonprofit, non-political service organization, some of our other projects that we're doing is to help with the veterans stand down. And we'll be donating a National Day of Service to Prado 40. And we are getting a national essay programs off the ground to our children at the various schools. And we'll be working the polls. I think we were assigned Ramona Garden this year. So thank you very much.
Thank you. I think people forget the history, and remember, I'm a history teacher, so I'm always going to be right here with you, Leslie. I think this is great. So, Council, if you have any comments, just go ahead and jump in. All right, let's go ahead and open up public comment then and see if anyone has comment on item 6C. This is our honorary proclamation for Constitution Week. AGP?
If any member of the public would like to comment on this, please raise your hand. Madam Mayor, there are no raised hands.
All right, thank you so much. This moves us to item 7. This is community comments and suggestions. This is the chance for the public to talk about items that are not on tonight's agenda. Please keep your comments to 3 minutes or less and address the council as one body. Again, I will turn it over to AGP.
Madam Mayor, we have 3 comments. The first speaker will be Janice Reed.
Hi, thank you. I'm wondering what's happening with Central Coast Blue, if we've ever heard anything from TISMO, if they've ever made a decision about our request, the letter that we wrote. I may have missed it, and if I did, I apologize for bringing it up again, but it's a big deal, and I'd like to know what's going on.
The next commenter is Jamie Sanbonmatsu.
While we're waiting for Jamie, Ms. Reed, typically for public comment, when there's questions, I write them down, and at the end of public comment, I'll have staff come in and make comments as necessary. So please don't hang up, hang in there, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Hello, I'm Jamie Sanbonmatsu, and I'm here again for We Are the Care. This month, as summer leans towards autumn, our children have begun to return to school and more parents return to work, and we are feeling a bit of hope in the world. The societal shift is allowing our economy some space to rebuild, but the drastic and devastating effects of the pandemic are being felt among working families. And in light of the current increase in COVID cases, there's still a little bit of anxiousness out there in our community and where we work with our young children. One way to simplify and conceptualize the challenges associated with the complicated childcare crisis is a trilemma, 3 equally important and necessary components of a thriving childcare system. We must be able to provide fair compensation to professionals who make up the childcare workforce. We must be able to provide high quality care for children and families, and childcare must be accessible and affordable. These 3 factors greatly influence the balance and sustainability of the business model for early care and education. And unless all 3 aspects are successful, the childcare crisis will continue. Childcare professionals and early care educators deserve to be paid a higher wage, and they deserve to be respected in our community for how truly essential they are. In SLO County, 24% of a median income family's budget goes to child care, which is more than housing. For over 2 years, We Are the Care have been building connections, gaining momentum, and searching for ways to address the childcare trilemma to support working families in SLO County. The family-friendly workplace toolkit that was created by We Are the Care has encouraged many businesses to reevaluate their practices and begin to shift towards family-focused approach. We are excited to announce that in addition to this toolkit, a family-friendly workplace accelerator program has been created. This program is housed at the SLO County Chamber of Commerce and is available as a free resource for businesses countywide with focus and on accelerating the adoption of family-friendly practices and workplaces and educating SLO County employers on strategies to sustain a strong local workforce through investments in quality child care and family-friendly workplaces. As always, We Are the Care. I appreciate your attention to the continued need in this area. And if you have any questions or would like to be involved, you can contact First Five in San Luis Obispo. Thank you once again, council members, for your time and support.
The last speaker is Jeff Edwards. Excuse me. Jeff, please unmute your microphone.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Mayor. Good evening, council members. My name is Jeff Edwards, and I wanted to provide a Central Coast Blue update for you, principally in connection with planning and permitting delays for the project. Pismo Beach has finally come to the realization CCB is going to be delayed for months, if not years. The injection wells, which are the centerpiece of the project, including three of the five wells that were slated for the county-owned Coastal Dunes RV Park and Campground along Highway 1. You may recall they did a test extraction well in the campground, and that was authorized by both the county and the Coastal Commission. But the injection wells are not allowed in the recreation land use category, which is applicable for the campground. Pismo Beach has known about this zoning inconsistency for over a year, but has basically been in denial. They did attempt to find some other locations, but have struck out in that regard, that locations for the injection wells, that is. SLO County and Coastal Commission LCP amendment process is very lengthy and cumbersome, with multiple steps. There's a initial required pre-application meeting. Then the matter goes to the Board of Supervisors for authorization. Then it proceeds to the Planning Commission for review and consideration. Then it goes back to the Board of Supervisors for final approval. Then it continues on to the California Coastal Commission for certification, and then returns back to the Board of Supervisors for acknowledgement of that consideration. And even with project-driven amendments, it takes many years in most cases. And at the end of the day, there's no guarantee for approval. Coincidentally, the CCB Pismo pre-application with county planning staff is scheduled for September 14th. It's the same day as your council will consider what your different water options and have that discussion. I would not tie my wagon to CCB. That's the message. And it appears to me that the CCB partnership framework may be the least of the problems in proceeding with that project. Thank you for your kind attention. And I am available if you have any questions. Thank you.
Madam Mayor, there are no more speakers.
Okay, and I want to check in with City Clerk. Anything written?
There are no written comments.
Okay, so I'd like to follow up on the member of the public's question. Maybe they missed the city manager's report, or maybe they want something just a little bit more in depth, but the question was, and presumably for Whitney, have we heard anything from Pismo? What's going on with Central Coast Blue?
So I'll try to provide a quick in a nutshell. So we have continued to discuss with the cities of Pismo Beach and Grover Beach potential options and the makeup of the cost-sharing arrangement. Sorry, I accidentally made myself, if we move forward with the project. So we did hear back, which was essentially let's sort of take a look at what other options might exist for a framework for this project between our cities moving forward. So I believe when you hear from us on September 14th, we will be able to provide a more in-depth discussion of what that will look like. So in essence, my hope and belief at this point is that we would be able to, if all of the councils are agreeable, and if our city wishes to continue on with the project, we would be able to do that most likely under some different terms from what we were discussing previously. So we will be able to get into that in more detail. At this point, I don't believe it's dead. The project itself is not dead and it's still moving forward. I know that Pismo Beach and Grover Beach have continued to work on it together and we've been kept in the loop and up to date on what's going on with their work in the background with grant applications, with the planning process. So that it hasn't gone away and we will definitely continue to keep talking about it.
Thank you very much. So definitely Ms. Reed, join us at our next meeting for sure. Cause that's the big one. That's the big kahuna coming up. All right, with that, I will close public comment and move forward to the consent agenda, and we'll check in with the council to see if they have items to ask questions, make comment, or have, I guess comments come later, but questions or want to consider separately. So I'll start with Councilmember Barnidge. Okay, Councilmember Storton.
Just in regards to AE, that's regarding the beer feast. What's the procedure to remove that? Do we just not vote on it?
Why don't we do all the questions in that
okay.
order like
I normally do? That sounds good. Okay. Someone will tell me then. Thanks.
And Councilmember George?
I have none, Mayor. Thank you.
Okay, Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
My only question would be if we need to pull item 8F to talk about the stage one declaration.
Well, I was planning to pull it anyway, so there you go. So we'll have two of us pull that one. So I would like to ask a brief question of staff on 8A. And I have two questions about 8F. So we'll go ahead and pull that. And we'll pull 8E to, I don't know if we're just deleting it or if we have to, if we have to take formal action on that. So let's go in order. So my question is for Director Valentine, is she here? I see her name there, but I'm missing her.
I am here.
Hi. So I'm sorry that I didn't email this to you before. I was just kind of reviewing the agenda as I was sitting here waiting for the meeting to start and something caught my eye. I noticed that on item 8A, the total number that we usually spend is somewhere in the neighborhood of like 340 something thousand. And this one jumped well over 400. Do you know why this one took a jump up?
Are you talking about for payroll?
Yes.
Okay. Let me go look at that real quick. So this is the first payroll where we included the pay increases of 3.5% for all staff. So I think this might be closer to our new average, but I can definitely do some investigating and see if that is the culprit or if there is something more specific in a particular line item.
Perfect. Thank you. That's good for now. Thank you so much for that.
You bet.
Item 8E. City Manager McDonald, do you want to advise us on that?
Thank you. Yes. So 8E, the applicant has requested to withdraw the application. And so we would actually, we're requesting that that item be withdrawn from the consent agenda. So I think we would ask for a vote for the items aside from 8E, because it's essentially not something that we would recommend any action be taken on.
Okay. And you don't need any separate, you don't need anything separate. Just don't consider it. Got it.
That's right.
Okay. And 8F, Mayor Pro Tem, your question?
Well, as our city manager was explaining during the city manager report, there was a timeline associated with our declaration, assuming the council moves forward with that, of a stage one water emergency. And so if you could just elaborate on that process under this item, I'd appreciate that.
I think I see that our utilities manager, Shane Taylor, is in the attendee list. I know he can probably walk us through that a little more in detail, knowing what those steps are. We've been here before, unfortunately, and so we will be revisiting that again. And you're right, there are procedures involved, including a public hearing notice. So maybe we'll see if Shane has more detail there.
I don't see myself, but can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. In our municipal code, chapter 13.07, if you're interested, describes the procedures to enact or consider to enact, I should say, when certain water supply conditions. There I am. I'm sorry. I've never done this on this. So certain water supply conditions exist. And of course, one of the triggers is that Lake Lopez reaches less than at 15,000 or below 8 acre feet of storage. And it's projected that will be at the end of next month. So we feel it prudent to engage the council with a consideration to enact a stage one water restrictions and all that entails to help conserve more water during this drought. And basically it's a public hearing to consider the actions we are proposing. For your information, the drought team is meeting tomorrow. We meet every other week, and we've been preparing for this public hearing. And tomorrow we're actually going to get into the numbers as far as the amount of reduction we're going to request for you to consider. Based on a couple of things. One, the low reservoir response plan went to the Board of Supervisors today, and I'm not sure if they adopted it, but I'm pretty sure they were going to. If that's the case, we're gonna cut back 10% of our deliveries starting tomorrow from the treatment plant. So we're going to look at the 2020 usage. That will be our baseline number. That's the way the ordinance is written, is to look at the previous year and then try and determine what customer classes, what reductions we need to ask for in percentages. And we haven't got to that point, but we're going to do that tomorrow as a group and come to some consensus to recommend to you to consider on September 28th. Does that help?
Definitely. I really appreciate that explanation. It's helpful to know, and I appreciate all the work that you're doing to be proactive regarding that. So thank you.
You're most welcome.
And I just...
Go ahead.
Sorry, I just realized some of the finer details on the hearing process. So we follow both the provisions of our own municipal code, but also the water code that sets forth a certain procedure We're required to provide a public hearing notice at least 7 days ahead of the hearing and publish that in the newspaper. So we will follow all of those steps, of course. But part of our process here, too, is it's helpful to get the word out that this is what we're anticipating doing so that folks know, here we are a month ahead. So we'll have all that for you at that meeting on the 28th.
Thank you. So my questions are a little more in-depth than that. So I seem to remember last time, well, first of all, I just texted Supervisor Compton and she said they did approve the low reservoir response plan today. So we're moving forward on that. I guess what I remember last time is this was so political that we attached measurement to whether or not we were going to go through the stages. And so I know that that's what you're talking about, Shane, is, you know, where are our Sentinel wells? Where is the low reservoir response plan? I know those things are all in play, that's what you're looking at in terms of when we're going to go to that stage one, to kind of take the political part of this out of it. So it's all scientific. So I appreciate that. But my question is, can you please remind me when we go to stage one, we're going to have some level of, or staff will recommend some level of restriction. And that's what you're talking about. How much will that be? What do you base that decision on, number one? And number two, what are some of the other just general ballpark? We already have a bunch of restrictions. What are the new ones potentially going to be for stage one?
Very good question, Mayor. So the majority of the effort that we're going to do in the next day or two is we have all the usage data from 2020, calendar year 2020, by our a single family residential, multifamily residential, commercial irrigation. And those are the categories that we will be looking for to determine how much water did, let's say, our tier one customers use in 2020? How much water did our tier two customers use? And tier three, and then our commercial irrigation. We do not put restriction currently this time on commercial accounts except for irrigation. So based on that, we have my idea that I'm going to present to the drought team tomorrow is to follow our guidance from the state of 15% from 2020. If we can try to get 15% from 2020, if you remember from the last drought, the state mandated for Arroyo Grande to have a 28% reduction from 2013. That was mandatory. It had a lot of teeth to it, fines if you don't do it. And we really stepped up the plate and saved a lot of water. And our customers have continued to save a lot of water. So obviously, our reductions that we're going to bring forth to you will be not that dramatic. We realize our customers have been conserving, but yet we still have to save water. And so we're looking at how do we get that 15% reduction from 2020 and evenly distribute that for our single family residential, multifamily, and commercial irrigation. Does that help at all?
It absolutely does. So thank you for that. And so am I hearing you right that the state, at least at this time, has not done anything mandated? That's just a strong suggestion. And is there anything else that comes in at stage one that is on maybe related to that list that we normally have that we kept from last time? Or is it just the reduction?
It's just the baseline reduction. So we're going to try and establish a baseline for each customer. I know Arroyo Grande, we have custom water conservation and it is cumbersome, but at the same time, I think it's extremely fair to all our customers. So everybody will get a baseline from based what they used in 2020, and then we'll ask for a certain percentage. For example, if you're in tier, what we call tier zero, that means you use 0 to 10 units every billing period, which is 2 months. We're going to ask you to just stay there. You're doing great. We're not going to ask for any reductions. And the numbers that we crunch tomorrow in our session will try to determine the tier one people from, let's say, 11 to 18 units, 19 to 20, 30 unit, 36 units is tier two. And then the people that are up above 37 units, what are we looking at? We're looking at 10%, 15% to get that overall 15% reduction. That's what we're working on tomorrow. Other restrictions, we have the constant mandatory restrictions about when you can water, how you can use water, what days to water. We have been reminding our customers. I've tagged probably 30 or 40 houses in the last month. But the people are very appreciative and they understand. And we've been chasing leaks. Unfortunately, we've had some unfortunate circumstances this last month. We had a couple of big leaks, not the city, but other people. But we're working on that. And I think people are starting to get the message. We've got our message boards out. I've seen on Grand Avenue and in the village. Hopefully that's catching some attention. And I know Jessica's been putting a lot of media posts out on our social media. And the cash for grass is blowing up. I mean, we've already probably got committed 40,000 square feet in like just a little over a month. We budgeted for 100,000. And there's actually been about 3 completed projects already. And that will immediately start saving water. So I'm optimistic, but the main restrictions will be the mandatory reductions in the single family residential, multifamily, and commercial irrigation.
And so when it comes forward potentially at the end of next month-ish, that's when we would talk about, are we going to do the water school we used to have or whatever you want to call it? Are we going to do penalties? We'll be talking about that later, right? So the public will get a chance to really have that conversation. So we wouldn't really do that here tonight, right?
That is correct. It's just, okay, great. That's one is to have you consider to declare a stage one restriction and all that entails, because it's a big deal. It's a very big deal. And it really puts a lot of burden on our staff, but that's okay. That's why we're here to do that. But, then we'll hopefully have a good formulation for you to consider at that meeting. And then you all can make the decision. And then there'll be some time. We have to notify all our customers, send out letters, establish baselines. We have to work with our billing system so that the customers see their baseline. And then, you know, our penalties, if you exceed. And you're right, I did do water school last time during the pandemic. I don't know how that's going to work. I haven't thought about that yet, but that was pretty successful, but it was another time in a different era. I'm not sure if that's going to work right now, but something to consider. And we'll talk about that at our drought team meeting also.
Thank you very much. I'm guessing that City Attorney Carmel popped his little window open to tell us to stop. Am I right, Mr. Carmel?
You are right, Madam Mayor. Okay. It's a very important subject matter, but the agenda description is not for stage one. It's a monthly report.
Thank you very much. All right, let's go ahead and open up public comment. I'll turn it over to AGP. This is for items 8A through 8F. Exclusive of 8E.
If any member of the public would like to speak on this, please raise your hand. Madam Mayor, there are no raised hands.
Thank you. And City Clerk Mattson, anything written?
No written comments.
Right, so let's bring it back to the council for discussion and possible action. Councilmember Dord?
I have no comments, thank you.
Okay, Councilmember Barnidge?
I have no comments, thank you.
Councilmember Storton?
I have none, thanks.
Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
No comments, thank you.
Well, nor do I, so I will go ahead and ask to see if anyone would like to make a motion for items 8A through F, exclusive of E.
Councilmember Storton, so moved.
Councilmember Barnett seconds that.
Any discussion? Okay, City Clerk Mattson, can we get a roll call, please?
Councilmember Storton?
Yes.
Councilmember Barnett?
Yes.
Councilmember George?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
Yes.
Mayor Ray Russell.
Yes.
That's fine. No worries.
Item 9 is public hearings. We have none tonight. Item 10, old business. We have none tonight. So this takes us to our new business item, item 11A. This is presentation of the 2020 annual report for the Northern Cities Management Area. So I will turn it over to Assistant City Manager and Public Works Director, Bill Robeson.
Good evening. Thank you, Mayor and City Council. We have Shane Taylor. He spoke pretty extensively on some items before, and he is prepared to give you a presentation tonight and fill you in on a lot of the water issues with the NCMA. So, Shane, go ahead and take it away.
Okay, so you guys can hear me? Okay. Very good. Well, I was really looking forward to doing this in person. I didn't do it last year, did it a number of years previous to that, but nonetheless, I'll do the best I can here on this Zoom presentation. So what this is we are the Northern Cities Management Area, of course, is Arroyo Grande, Grover Beach, Pismo Beach, the Oceana Community Services District, and local ag community and private users. We prepare, we meaning the NCMA and our technical consultants. They gather data throughout the year. This is for calendar year 2020. And we do a lot of work to determine this status of the groundwater basin in the Northern Cities Management Area. And GSI Incorporated is our hydrological consultant, along with Water System Consulting, to help us put this report together. And then we were required, as part of the stipulation and settlement, to submit this to the Superior Court in the County of Santa Clara to Judge Kerwin, and submit that at the very end of April, and then they accept the report and we move on. And it's a very detailed report. I don't know if any of you want to have looked at it, but it's 188 pages, a lot of charts and graphs, but it's important and it goes to show the detail that we do put into it and a lot of money. I mean, it's not cheap to do this. As you can see, we spend over $100,000 just Arroyo Grande, and Grover actually spends more than we do because they have more groundwater entitlement. But what we want to do is give you the opportunity to get a synopsis of this report for 2020. And so that you have a good understanding of the groundwater basin and its conditions and how it affects our water supply. And it's coming at a very important time. And this presentation, this PowerPoint, was really done by GSI. We, in just a matter of a few, like a week from now, we also do this presentation to our local ag community. We meet with them and go over the report and so that they're aware, since of course the agricultural community does utilize the basin more than anyone else, even more than the cities do as far as urban pumping. And we want to make sure that the agricultural representatives in the NCMA are aware of all the work we're doing and that they understand the situation of the basin. And they appreciate it very much. And we work cooperatively together to hopefully manage this basin in a good, sustainable way as best we can. And this report is part of that. We learn a lot from all the data gathering. So with that, Jessica, if you want to cue up that PowerPoint.
Yes, I will share my screen right now. Just 1 second. Okay. All right. You just let me know when to advance it, Shane.
Okay. So there you go. And that opening, Paul Sorensen and Nate Page. Paul Sorensen's a very renowned hydrogeologist, and he's pretty much the lead man for GSI. And Nate Page is also a geologist, hydrogeologist, that puts this report together. And then we review it along with our attorneys and make sure everybody's happy with it before it's submitted to the Superior Court. On those pictures, there's the dunes looking out on the ocean. And there on the lower right hand is a monitoring well system. And what you can see is those are just little 2-inch pipes that go, and they're in a big metal barrel that is locked and tamper proof. And those are the sentry wells. And we have clusters of those up and down the coast from Pismo Beach Campground all the way down to mile marker 3 on the Oceano Dunes. And what they do is every quarter they go out and monitor. In other words, they pull water out of those little wells. They're all screened at different levels. And we take samples, and then those are sent to the lab for analysis for key constituents like sodium and chloride and manganese and potassium, several indicators to get a background chemistry of the water that's being pulled out of there. And also in those wells, we have data loggers, and they take their laptop and download, and that gives them, these data loggers are measuring water depth and electric conductivity. You know, that's a big word, but it's how well water will transmit electricity. Obviously, if there's more minerals or salts in the water, it will have a higher electronic conductivity. So they gather all this stuff from these little monitoring wells and then put together a little quarterly report. And then after all 4 quarters, they compile the annual report. So there's what those little monitoring wells look like, or sentry wells. Go to the next slide. So let's look at it. We're going to look at 2020. Remember how much rain we have in the evapotranspiration, the demand we had in 2020 as far as water. We're going to figure out what our kind of condition our basin's in and some key findings. Next slide. And there's a good picture of the Santa Maria groundwater basin. As you can see, it's divided when the basin became adjudicated. The courts divided into 3 management areas. The Santa Maria Valley, of course, is much the largest one. You can see it goes way out past Sisquoc, all the way to the ocean out of Guadalupe. And then it includes Santa Maria, Guadalupe, Orcutt, and a lot of other areas. The Napomo Mesa management area. And then, of course, our area at the northern cities. Those are that's the aerial of it. And each one of these 8 management areas is required to do exactly what we do, is create an annual monitoring report and basin conditions. So Both other management areas create the same report, basically, but with all different data that we do to submit to the Superior Court. Next slide. And then, of course, here's a close-up of our management area from Pismo Beach down past the Dune Lakes over to the Bluff, Mesa Bluff. And then basically the 101 is the eastern boundary. And you can see we have some faults running through our basin, the Wilmar Fault, Santa Maria Fault, Oceano Fault. Reason faults are important is they can affect the way water moves throughout the basin. There's our partners in managing us, Pismo, Grover, Oceano, and the private users. Next slide. So here's the 2020 hydrology. So our average rain is 15.6 inches. In 2020, we fell very short of that, 10 inches. So if you look on the upper graph, that's rain in inches. And the lower graph is evapotranspiration. So the bad news is we had below average rainfall in 10 of 12 months. And the evapotranspiration exceeded rainfall in 11 of 12 months. Evapotranspiration basically is the process by which water is transferred from the land to the atmosphere through evaporation or through the transpiration of plants. And the sum of that is this evapotranspiration. That's the lower graph down here. You can see we had a good March in 2020. And a pretty good April. But other than that, not so good. 10 inches is not a good number. So here we are. But that was 2020. Next slide. And of course, we talked about our agricultural partners in the basin. And one of the key features of the Northern Cities Management Areas, we have a lot of farming in the Cienega Valley. And the ag wells don't have meters and they don't report their pumping. So we have to have a system of determining how much water they're actually using to grow crops. And the best way our consultants can do that is they know what parcels of land and area and what crops are being grown. As you can see, the majority are rotational crops, or I call them truck crops, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower, lettuce, you name it. But interestingly, strawberries are making a comeback here, as you can see, especially across from the high school. That hadn't been planted in strawberries in a long time, and now it is. So strawberry production's come up a little bit in 2020. And avocados are becoming very popular at the fringes of the NCMA. I don't know if you've driven up to JJ's Market lately up on the Mesa, but there's some serious avocado action going on up there. So all these crops use different amounts of water, and that's how our consultants determine actual water uses. It's estimated, but it's very technical, and they feel pretty confident in the reliability of the numbers they come up with as far as pumping. Next slide. So here it is, estimated ag pumpage. You can see rotational crops, almost 2,000 acre feet, strawberries, 273, and then avocados up to 45. I remember not even seeing avocados a few years ago. So, of course, the farmers go where they can make the best living. So overall, the ag pumping is 2,308 acre feet estimated. Next slide. And then we have our pumping from the basin, and all of the municipal wells are metered. And we report these actually monthly at our technical group meetings. So in 2020, look at it right, Randy. We were groundwater champion, very, very conservative. We only pumped 39 acre feet. That's almost just maintenance pumping for required sampling. We relied heavily on Lopez because we have a take or pay contract with them, with the county. We only really pump if we have to. And fortunately, we didn't have to pump hardly any water. Grover Beach was the big one because their Lopez allotment is much smaller. And Pismo and Oceano. So you can see the urban pumping between us is very low, 15% of our allotment. And then there's the groundwater for the ag. And then we do have non-potable irrigation. That 61 acre feet is from a well there at Elm Street Park that we use to water the Soto Sports Complex and also provide non-potable water for construction. And then we got a few rural users out there, Town of Halcyon, down there at the Pacific Dunes. There's people out there have their own wells in the basin. So overall, 32% of the entitlement or allotment. We only pump 32% or a little over 3,000 acre feet. Next slide. And then we got total usage. As you can see, we use 2,317 acre feet. So we use 2,242 Lopez. Our entitlement is 2,290, so we didn't even use all our entitlement. Then we have other supplies. That's our wells in the Pismo Formation, wells 9 and 10. And we utilized, and we did pump well 10 last year and extracted 36 acre feet. So that takes put a little break on the basin. The Pismo Formation is a totally separate groundwater basin. It's outside of the adjudication, so it doesn't impact our Santa Maria water. No one else has that wells. None of the other municipalities have wells in the Pismo Formation. Excuse me. So overall, 8,577 was the total use. See, most of it is surface water. You can see Pismo utilize a good amount of state water as Oceano started to use state water, but not very much, only 60 acre feet. But totals are low in 2020. Next slide. This is a good graph. The green water is at the green line on the bottom. That's state water project. And you see it had a little bit of an uptick. And you're going to see even next year's report even more of an uptick because Pismo and Oceano are using state water almost exclusively and not taking any Lopez water, which is a benefit to the lake. Lopez water had a little uptick there. But you can see the groundwater, the blue line is diving down to the lowest point almost ever since this graph starts back in 1986. So we're really conserving the groundwater. And overall, the black line is overall and you can see the trend through the drought. We had a little rebound. Now it's coming back a little bit, coming up a little bit, but overall our groundwater use is almost at a record low. Next slide. And just, we talked about those Century wells. Here's where they are. that North Beach campground up there. They're up there. There's some clusters there over by the Ranger Station off of Highway 1. Find Pure Liquor on Pure Avenue. At the campground there, there's a set. And then over at the Oceano Railroad Depot in the parking lot, there's some wells that were put in, and we monitor well number 8 there. And then we have a monitoring well along the Mesa Bluff, right at the bottom of the bluff there, just below Valley Road. Not Valley Road, Halcyon, I'm sorry. And then Oceano Dunes, that's at mile marker 3 for everyone that's gone down on the beach. That's the last sentry wells we have along the coast. So these are the wells that we monitor every quarter, 5 clusters, 16 wells total. And that's where they're at. Next slide. And so our consultants, when they get all this data, and then the county of San Luis Obispo also helps us in the fact that the county monitors wells twice a year in April and October. And we get that data from the county, and we can fill in the gaps and create these groundwater contours. In other words, these lines are where the water is at in the basin above sea level. As you can see, the wells here, here's our municipal wells, here's the sentry wells, and here's the contours. Now this green area is kind of a new addition our consultants have decided to put in as the alluvial aquifer. So our wells don't pump from the alluvium. They're more in the actual basin. There's two parts of our basin, the Paso Robles Formation, the Carriaga, the actual aquifer. These are the ag well areas, and they're much more shallow. They're the old riverbed deposits, or not river, but creek bed deposits before Lopez Dam, and for thousands of years, the alluvial fan as the creek went out to the ocean deposit all these alluvium soils. And as you can see, in the spring, we have 10 feet above sea level. And even in the spring after some rain, we're at 0 here over here by the Mesa. And then along the coast, we're hanging in there about 10 feet above sea level. So our wells were between 10 and 20 feet above sea level, our municipal wells. Next slide, and then we'll go to the fall. And what happens? Well, obviously, it was a poor winter, a poor year. Along the coast, they've gone down to 5 feet above sea level. Over here in the Dune Lakes area, we're at sea level, or actually 5 feet below sea level. In the alluvial of Lower Cienega Valley, we're 10 feet below sea level, right at sea level. Our municipal wells are hanging in at about 10 feet above sea level. Obviously, a drop. And, oh, this is kind of cool. They put in our little Pismo wells up here. You can see them where my pointer is. Obviously, outside of the basement, that's where they're at. Next slide.
Shane, yeah. Shane, this is, just so you know, we can't see your pointer because Jessica's the one that's got control.
Oh, of I am so sorry. My bad. I apologize for it. I did not realize I should have. But anyway, you can ask me questions later. But you can see the contouring in this fall. Of course, the water levels are lower. But our wells, our municipal wells, are hanging in there at 10 feet above sea level last fall. And I've seen it worse. But I've seen it better. So anyway, next slide. And then of all those sentry wells that we sample every quarter, we pick, there's our consultants have picked 3 indicative wells that mimic the same areas that we extract from in the basin. And we, the average of those three monitoring wells, we create what we call as the deep well index. And the theory behind it is, if we stay above 7.5 feet with those monitoring wells on average, 7.5 feet above sea level, we're going to be okay. And seawater intrusion is going to stay away. The unfortunate trend here is from 1965 until now, they've drawn a line through these ups and downs of the basin, and the trend is not good. The trend is lowering, and we want to try and reverse that trend as best we can, or at least keep it flat. But it did drop in 2020. We see we had a little uptick, but then we had the devastating drought. We had the recovery, but now we're back, rolling back down again. But we, at the end of 2020, we were still above the 7.5 threshold. Next slide. So what are the key findings? We used a little more Lopez Lake water than we did in 2019. We used more water overall, but 370 plus acre feet, not a whole lot, but water use was up slightly. More state water, we actually pumped less groundwater, and we, at least the Roy Grande, we pumped a little more from the Pismo formation than we did in 2019. So the groundwater pumping is 32% of the 9,500 acre safe yield, acre feet per year safe yield, and that comes from our groundwater management agreement. And we also have to, part of reporting, even though the basin is adjudicated, you still have to do a SGMA, that's the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and the state wants us to report the state of our change of storage. And our consultants estimate we had a decrease of 500 acre feet in 2020 in storage, which isn't a lot, but nonetheless, it's a decrease. And the sad part is we pump less water and we still are losing water. So that's a tough thing to swallow, but there it is. Next slide. And here's the question, why aren't the water levels higher in the basin? Well, here we're back with another drought, and our rainfall's been sporadic. I mean, not getting the rain at the right times. We have some reduction of the recharge from the east. In other words, that water that normally would come into our parts of the basin has been reduced. It's not because we're over pumping here. We've really cut back on pumping, as you can see. Next slide. And what are our threats? Well, continued reduction in the underflow from the east. God forbid seawater intrusion, but that's why we do all this work. Is we're watching that sentry wells are exactly that. They're on guard. And if we see anything as indicating insipid seawater intrusion, we're going to see it, but it's always a threat, especially in times of drought. And of course, as the lake drops, and possibly even threat to state waters hanging in there, but it's only delivering at 5%. The only reason our contractors can still deliver state water at their levels they are is because they have stored water up at San Luis Reservoir up in Northern California, and they have drought buffer. But it's as Lopez drops, like we said, the low reservoir response plan, we're going to lose 10% of our supply right there. We've got to get that water from somewhere, and that's going to be from our wells. So we're going to have a little more increased groundwater demand in 2021, which I've seen already. Next slide. So that was it, but I want to show you some more detail. Here's our consultants out there on the upper left-hand corner at mile marker 3. doing their monitoring and over at the Oceano Depot. And they take great care. It's about a two-day process for these guys to do all this work every quarter. And then we've got to send all this stuff to the lab, get it certified. So there's a big effort to watch our basin, monitor our basin, share the information with everyone, keep everyone informed, be as transparent as possible as to the real conditions, what's going on out there, so we can make good decisions. And I'm available for any questions.
All right, thank you so much. Let's check in with the council and see who does have questions. Let's start with Councilmember George.
Thank you, Shane. That was an incredible presentation. I appreciate the in-depth information. Is it possible for us to look at page 14 of the presentation? I just wanted to get some clarification.
Sure.
I'm just really slow trying to hear, taking everything you said.
And it's a lot. And if you read the report, it's even more. So if Jessica can find page 14. Or you mean slide 14?
I just said, it said 14 at the bottom. I thought it was page 14, but it might be slide. It was a graph with a line going down.
Oh, could you find that?
I'll pull up the report that was in the packet in just a second here.
It was a
presentation. It was one of the PowerPoint slides.
Oh, okay. Okay.
It was a PowerPoint slide.
Yeah, so go back up.
I think like just two, maybe.
I'm trying to go back here. Sorry, give me one moment. Let me fix this.
So while we're waiting for that slide, the last slide that showed the trucks trying to get the water, the test samples, and you said those get sent off to be analyzed. What are we analyzing for?
Oh, quite a number of things. Obviously, sodium, chloride, potassium. There's a whole range of constituents. I've got the list here in this report. It's a lot of minerals, a lot of different minerals. And what we are looking for is any constituents that would mimic the minerals in seawater. So those are the things we're looking for. Any spikes in chloride, sodium, potassium that match what the seawater chemistry is. That's kind of what we're looking for at the lab.
Okay, perfect. And that leads me to the question that was on this page, because I had written down some of the numbers that you were giving us prior to this page. And basically, you said as far as the municipal sea level, water level, that we were roughly about 10 to 15 feet above sea level, correct?
Yeah, so the deep well index in the spring, we were right about 10 feet above sea level. And then at the end of the year, we were about a little over above 7.5 there, slightly. And that's the average of those three key sentry wells.
So when do we get, like, what is the threshold for seawater intrusion? Is there a certain number of feet above sea level that we're like, okay, now we have to be really concerned?
Yes. What we use is if we fall below the deep well index of 7.5 feet above sea level for 6 consecutive quarters. So for a year and a half, if we stay below 7.5 feet, there's a good chance, based on previous years of analyzing, we probably are going to start seeing seawater intrusion or evidence of it.
So these three wells that you're using as sample wells, the numbers that you were giving us, some were municipal, some were on the coast. So is this a sampling of no?
No, they're all in the sentry well. So we use a well up by the Pismo Beach Campground, North Pismo Beach, one on Pier Avenue, and one down on mile marker 3. These are all sentry wells along the coast.
Okay.
Only. And So, for example, in this month's report, we just did the third quarter samples in July, and we just finally dropped below 7.5. We're at 7.25. So this would be the first quarter that we have been below the 7.5 threshold with that index average. So we're still okay. That's nothing to be too worried about. As you can see, we've done that before. But we got one more quarter to analyze, and that'll be in October. And it'll probably be two quarters below. So that gives us still another year to recover before we hit the sixth quarter. There's no magic number other than obviously going to zero. our consultants have determined, and our experts, if we stay below 7.5 for a year and a half, there's a good chance we will see the beginnings of seawater intrusion.
And do we have somewhere in like some giant library, a mystical location that has a game plan if we're looking into like the fifth quarter and we realize that sixth quarter isn't going to look so hot? Do we have an action plan, or is that something that part of discussing CCB?
Well, there's a number of things, but as a cooperative management group, we obviously will start making recommendations as this trend continues to all of us, and also the farmers. You know, they're a big part of it. So, you know, we're going to keep them informed. They may have to fallow some land, you know, or stop pumping or reduce their pumping or not pump their entire acreage. Those are decisions they're going to have to make. So we work together. Does that answer your question?
Yes. Yes, okay. It does. Thank you very much. Those were my questions. I appreciate the report.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Councilmember Storton?
Great. Thank you. Yes, just a few questions. I'm so thankful for many of the people that deal with this technology. And Shane, you being the face of it, speaking to us tonight, I really appreciate your knowledge and experience in this area. I just had a couple of questions. I was curious, it mentioned in the report, certainly we're broken up into three different areas with Santa Maria, Napomo, and ourselves. Can you talk about how use in the areas to the south of us impact water flows in our area?
Well, sure. As the natural flow gradient, so to speak, is from the Santa Maria Valley, northwest through the Mesa, and then up through our management area out to the ocean, that's the natural gradient of the water. So that water in the basin, I try to explain it to people, it's not like there's a big lake under the ground there. It's just very saturated aquifer. It's like a sponge, so to speak. And there is a natural flow. The water does move and transmit through the soil under the earth, through the earth, I should say. And as that flow has been occurring for thousands of years, obviously, or millions, but with development in the Napomo Mesa and our area and Santa Maria, obviously blowing up, my goodness, you can see on those groundwater contours to the east of us, the Mesa, there are areas that are under sea level. Their wells, and they have these pumping depressions, and that natural flow that has occurred for all this time is not quite making it to us. So that is impacting our basin. And the Mesa parties are well aware of it. Their annual report, they realize they have trouble. That's one of the reasons they were required as part of the stipulations to bring in supplemental water, which they've been trying very hard to do. And they did get the supplemental water project. Unfortunately, it's not delivering the water amounts that we were hoping for, but it eventually will. I think last year they brought in a little over 1,000 acre feet, 1,041 actually. But Mesa, especially with their pumping depressions, according to our experts, is interrupting that flow to us. So that's how they're impacting us.
Okay. And you did mention it, and you talked about development, and certainly there's talk of off of Willow, a very large residential commercial development that is being looked at. Santa Maria is obviously growing extensively. How do we work with those partners as we have these discussions about water use and how it does impact us since we're further down the road? Do we engage in much in conversations with them as we look at the seriousness of the issue?
We do have occasional meetings with the Napomo Mesa management area, and our hydrogeologists work with their hydrogeologists to get their groundwater contours. We exchange information and work cooperatively with the other parties, not so much as Santa Maria. I'm not sure if Santa Maria and Napomo get together, but we mostly get together with the Napomo Mesa people. That's NCSD, Golden State Water, Woodlands, Phillips 66. And then, of course, they've got a lot of ag pumpers also. But they are well aware. The development, I'm not quite sure what you're talking about, but that's all in the unincorporated county. And I know they have restrictions and development guidelines as far as water and future water use. And we're depending on the county to oversee that and make sure before any development like that is approved that it does have a sustainable water supply, whether that be more supplemental water from Santa Maria, be a state water, or some other source of water.
Okay. In regards to seawater intrusion, other than us building technologies, whether it's Central Coast Blue or some other form of technology to increase the level of our aquifers, are there any natural corrective measures that help stop seawater intrusion? I imagine more rain, obviously.
Yeah. It needs to rain. Yes. We continue to try and capture more of our stormwater runoff. The low impact development that's now in place, water that just used to run off in the street and down into the drainage and out to the ocean, we're capturing a lot more of that and putting it back in the ground through percolation. Even all new development, they have to capture their runoff and store it. A good example is the new shopping center, the redeveloped shopping center there on Elm and Grand. When they redeveloped that, all that water used to sheet off all those parking lots and go in the storm drain system. It's actually now stored in underground vaults. And we have that throughout even small developments like a PUD that was once one house turns into eight. There's underground storage requirements so that all that water is put back into the ground through storage. So that's one of the mechanisms that we can increase our groundwater supply by capturing a lot of that water as best we can and putting it back in the ground through percolation. And of course, we need more rain, and the supplemental water project of some sort, which could have been desal, or there's a number of other opportunities out there to supplement water. And we're going to hopefully bring you a list of those to consider in the coming months. But we need it to rain, council member.
Okay. Easy answer.
That's we need better rainfall.
Okay. Well, we'll work on that one. Thank you very much. Those are all my questions for now. My other ones were answered.
Thank you.
All right, Councilmember Barnage.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't have any questions. Thank you for the report, Shane. I just have a brief comment. Shane, you mentioned that there were the farmers, they can always fields fallow. And actually, just today, I was emailing back and forth with a local farmer in Arroyo Grande. And he said, actually, because someone had emailed me about just some concerns about some overhead watering versus drip on some fields. And I assumed it was because of the different crops, and that was correct. But he did tell me that they have, this particular farmer has left fields fallow this year. And he said that they usually get three crops in an area off of cherry, but he's only going to get two crops. And then he also mentioned another farming family that is also letting some crops go fallow as well. So, and he said the drought is obviously on top of their minds at all time, as you know, and I know from sitting on zone three. So they're just as concerned as we are because they can't grow anything if they don't have water. So, anyway, I just wanted to sort of pass that on, and I don't have any questions, but thanks for the report, Shane.
You're welcome.
Mayor Pro Tem Pelding?
Just a couple of quick questions. And again, I appreciate the comprehensive report, Shane. Actually, on the subject of our farmers in the community, it's my understanding that because we're an adjudicated basin, we're not actually implementing a groundwater sustainability plan. Under SGBA. That's correct, right, Shane?
That is correct.
Okay. And ag has overlayer water rights. So there really isn't a way to impose, cutback restrictions from a municipal standpoint. Is that correct?
At this moment in time, you are correct. As long as they can pay PG&E, they can pump what they need to pump.
Okay. Well, and obviously there are partners, and as was just being discussed, they're going to take actions in and of themselves to do what's right. And I guess my question is, as we look at incentive programs like our Cash for Grass, are there ways to incentivize farmers to shift, use new technologies, irrigation methods, things like that, that we might look at as a city moving forward to incentivize those types of changes? Again, just acknowledging that they are our biggest groundwater user.
Well, that's a really good question. Really haven't thought about it much. I do know, doing this job for so long as I have, that the irrigation technology has improved dramatically. They used to flood irrigate. For heaven's sakes, they used to, put the water out there and run it down the furrows. And that's gone to the overhead spray. Now they use the T-tape or the drip on a lot of this stuff. So they're the farmers are very astute at being more efficient. As far as having some incentives for farmers in our city, I haven't thought about that. They don't pay any, we do not supply any ag water to any of our farmers in the city. They develop their own water. So it'd be, just thinking about it right now, it'd be hard to incentivize when they're not our customers, so to speak, but something to consider. Think about it.
And I appreciate that. And sorry for putting you on the spot. The question just occurred to me as we were having discussion. So it's a definitely an interesting part of the equation, but that makes perfect sense. And then on the slides, there was a bullet that we're only using 32% of our 9,500 acre feet safe yield. But the reality is as we see that decline, or the line trending in the direction of the decline, we really probably, if we were using 9,500 acre feet per year as an agency, that probably wouldn't be sustainable, right? So there's to rephrase, the safe yield as indicated probably isn't really safe.
Yeah, that number comes, just so you know, that number comes from the 1979 Department of Water Resources report on the Arroyo Grande Tri-City Mesa back in the late 70s. And at that time, that's what DWR determined was the sustainable yield of this area. Of course, times were much different then. And as we progressed through time, through the 80s, it became obvious to groundwater managers that we, in this area, we needed to probably have a better plan than just pump, 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 and have some accountability. That was where the gentleman's agreement came forth. But you're absolutely right. That number is and is improving to be suspect in the fact that it's, oh, you're right. If we did pump that, there's a good chance we would have sewer intrusion. And we realize that, but at the same time, at some point in time, it was a good number when things, when conditions were different, and we're trying to get back to some point of getting to a more hydraulic balance throughout the basin. And that's the supplemental water project from Santa Maria, where they're bringing in a lot of imported water. And Napomo, as the Mesa parties have, to, you know, going to take some of that water and offset their pumping, which hopefully at some point will help restore some of that natural underground flow into our portion of the basin. But yes, you are correct. That number is, and the hydraulic model that we've done has determined that that number is high. And then we're working through that to come up with a amended groundwater management agreement. We're still in process. But with the pandemic and all the stuff going on, that's kind of been sidetracked at this time, but we'd eventually come to a more adaptive management, they call it, of using our new tool sets to determine based on we can do. Now we have a real true groundwater model that's been vetted and calibrated. We can take inputs from, let's say, we know how much rain we got this last winter. We can put that as an input into the model and see what really the basin could deliver safely. We're looking at that, those kind of technologies and that kind of use to more cooperatively manage and bring the basin more into balance.
I appreciate that, all of the work going in that direction. And I'll just say, yeah, I look forward to obviously the gentleman's agreement being modified to reflect more realistic goals, essentially, and requirements. Because I think from a transparency standpoint, even to the public, to look at, you know, the statistic that we're only using 32% of the quote-unquote entitlement is kind of misleading based on what we know now. And it can give us a false sense of security. And so I think it would be really important, notwithstanding the legalities of those entitlements and the adjudicative process, for us to look at that. But I really appreciate your explanation, Shane, and all the questions asked by council. But those are my comments. Thank you, Mayor. Or questions, excuse me.
You're most welcome.
Shane, I just have one question. Maybe Councilmember Barnidge can answer this. Did we get any relief whatsoever out of the cloud seeding pilot program in 2020?
Actually, we got a little teeny bit. Yeah, they gave us a report at the TAC meeting. There wasn't a lot of storms, to be honest. We had one big one in January, and we had a couple in March. February was a bust. But the good news is that it's there and ready for action again this winter and fall and spring, right there up at Reservoir 4. And it is a viable technology. I know a lot of people think it's hokum or whatever you want to call it, but it really does work. It's been proven to work. But this last winter, the answer is no, we didn't see a lot because there wasn't any really a lot of storms to seed. So hopefully we get a better pattern of storms coming this fall and winter and spring, and we can utilize our cloud seeding site along with the other ones within Santa Barbara County. So we have approved the Zone 3 budget to continue the cloud seeding program, only land base. So the land base flares, but we were able to have our site constructed on our property through the flood control district. And I'm looking forward to being positive that yes, this winter, our cloud seeding will produce some much needed more rainfall in our watershed.
Do you have any idea what the real number was?
Not off the top of my head. I'd have to look at the report. It was minimal. Yeah, it was. But on average, reading and studying about cloud seeding, it's about 15% increase of normal. So, and we actually did cloud seed back in the 90s when we had a pretty severe drought. And we did see about a 20% increase at the lake. And that was with airplanes and land base. But last winter, it was minimal, very minimal. But some. There just wasn't any storms to speak of.
Good enough for now. Thank you so much. All right, let's go ahead and check in with AGP and open up public comment.
If any member of the public would like to speak on this, please raise your hand. Madam Mayor, there are no raised hands.
Thank you. So I'll bring it back around to the council. And let's start with Councilmember Barnidge, and maybe she has anything to add. I don't know. I got my answer, but if you had anything more, go ahead. And you can start with Tommy.
Yeah, thank you, Mayor. I don't really have a lot to add. I think maybe we, just going from memory, we seeded maybe two storms, I think. And the bummer about cloud seeding is it's amazing when you have a storm, but if you don't have any storms, then you just don't get any additional rain per se. Santa Barbara County has been doing cloud seeding forever and ever and ever, and so it's definitely not a new concept. So I'm excited because at least it's something. I think we have to, you know, we have to kind of pull everything out of our toolbox and use that. So I think it is a tool. But like Shane said, it worked and it's effective, but we just need more bigger storms. But it is cost effective. And so I don't have any other comments other than that. And I'll just do a rain dance sometime soon.
Thank you for that. And the offer for the rain dance on behalf of Aurora County. Councilmember George, any comments?
Thank you. I'm wondering if Councilmember Barnidge can do the rain dance when she's at the booths talking about district elections. I have no comments. Thank you so much for the report. I appreciate all the effort and hard work that you continuously do for us, Shane. And I have no other comments.
Councilmember Storton?
Agreed, Shane. Thank you so much for the report. A lot of work has been put into this. It's going to be great information as we look forward to other meetings about other solutions, conservation, Central Coast Blue, and other supply options. So it just helps add to our decision-making process. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Paulding?
Thank you. A couple questions, well, comments. So the thing that concerns me the most, notwithstanding the fact that we don't, you know, have the rainfall we need, is the fact that we're seeing that those depressions on the Napomo Mesa in the Cienega Valley that aren't, you know, being addressed in the sense of actually trying to address recharge in those areas. Councilmember Storton mentioned the fact that we have new development being proposed in Napomo. I know that the solution there is, as you mentioned, Shane, bringing in more water from the supplemental water project through the city of Santa Maria. So the NCSD can provide more water in that way, and so that creates a water opportunity for that new development. But what about those depressions? And what about the fact that those depressions are impacting our city and region? So to me, if we can strengthen the communication, the collaboration between the partners of the NCMA to work with the NMMA to kind of address that issue, because we're seeing it being reported in the NMMA reports and the NCMA reports, but I'm not seeing a solution being discussed, although obviously projects like the Central Coast Blue Project will help recharge the basin as we inject more water. So from a city standpoint, I think that it's important we prioritize that issue. Other than that, great report. It's a sad state of affairs. Hope it rains, and I'm excited to continue to work on good projects that will provide new sources of water.
And for me, I wish I could back up to this time last year and just replay whatever it was we said, because it's the same report every year, and it's challenging without a doubt. And I'm just very much looking forward to our water discussion at the next meeting. So I'm going to kind of say thank you very much to Shane and to our consultants. And this is a receive and file, and then go forwards for some really robust discussion next month. So thank you. This takes us to item 12, which is, and I fast forwarded in my agenda here, council reports. So for me, well, let me get my notes here, and it got dark. I can't see everything. CJPIA is about to have its annual meeting in October. And because council member George is attending the annual meeting, the risk management meeting, in San Diego, which I promise you is going to be great. I've been to that one before, and it's really, really good. You will not regret going down there. But since she's already there, I don't have to drive 6 hours, so she's going to be the rep on that. So we'll hear from her in October. Sanitation District met at the beginning of August, and not much on the just regular business. We did our annual review of our performance review of our district attorney. And he, flying colors, everything is fine. And it was just announced today that Sanitation District is going back to virtual meetings as well. We have conflicts at the first meeting in October due to the Chamber's annual dinner and the risk assessment or the risk management CJPIA event that Councilmember George is going to. So it looks like we may be moving that to the third week of October. So I'll remind you all again when we do council communications at the end of September, but it looks like our October meeting will be pushed. And see if there's anything else there. The T-bid was an interesting meeting yesterday. That will be coming forward to council, so I don't want to say too much here, but the upshot of that is there is a group similar to the group that was coming forward today with the beer feast that is asking for T-bid monies for lighting up the village at Christmas time. So we will be getting a staff report on that. The T-bid itself had some questions and some recommendations. It does require council action because they're asking for money that is not in the T-bid budget, so that would come out of reserves. So that's coming forward sometime in the next couple of meetings. And finally, I don't want to give too much of an update here, but and I'm sure that Councilmember Storton will speak more, but the mayor's meeting was all about IWMA. And I will let him, I have a giant page full of notes here to share with you, but I'm going to let him do that because he's probably better versed than I am, but the upshot is perhaps it may be time for us to consider making some sort of public statement for all seven cities to who desire, or all the cities who desire to stay in the IWMA. So I can, I'll defer to Councilmember Storton on that as well. And I have a lot of questions about what I heard at the meeting. So I would presume that once we have some more information that we'll be bringing this forward through staff, you know, for our own item here in AG. But I'm stumbling because I could probably talk and ask questions for a half an hour on this. And I think it's probably about time we're going to have to agendize it and get everybody up to speed. So with that, those are my reports, and let's go to Mayor Pro Tem Paulding.
Thank you. The Air Pollution Control District Board meets next month. The Briscoe Halcyon Interchange Subcommittee has not met, and SLOCOG and the RTA are meeting next week on Wednesday. So I have nothing to report.
All right, thank you for that brief report. Councilmember Barnage?
Thank you. I just have actually the HSOC, the full HSOC has not met, but the executive HSOC met on August 18th, and I'm going to give a short report because there was just there was a lot of information, good information that came out of that. As you can imagine, there's all kinds of stuff going on in regards to the unhoused with the grants and COVID, et cetera. So let's see, we got an update from Haslow, gave an update on the emergency housing voucher program that they have. And it was just heartbreaking to learn, but not surprising, that they received 500 referrals for that program. They have 300 vouchers from the feds, but have only housed 30 people. They offered signing bonuses of $4,000 to landlords that have never housed a Section 8 client, and offered rental damages insured up to $7,500. The good news is they were able to recruit five new landlords, so that's really good news. The bottom line, as you can tell, is that we have a desperate need for housing, which everyone knows. The help is there with all the nonprofits trying to put people into houses and also trying to case manage them and help them be successful. And the money's actually there now, a lot of money, but there's no housing. So as you can see, they have 300 vouchers and they can't use them. They house 30 people and 500 people applied. So there was an update from the Board of Supervisors meeting from August 10th, and they funded $1.5 million towards the unhoused. And some of the items they funded were the blue bag program, which I don't know if you guys are familiar, but they drop off the big blue bags at different homeless encampments, and it's a pickup that then the county comes and picks up the bags, so it keeps sort of the trash and everything out of the creeks, et cetera. They funded three safe parking sites throughout the county, locations yet to be determined. We could have one in Arroyo Grande or South County, don't know yet. And City of SLO is currently running a test case of a safe parking location at the Railroad Depot. It has 7 to 8 cars every night. They funded a program manager for, I believe the program manager is to help manage the blue bag program and the safe parking program. They funded encampment mapping software, and they also funded a regional communication plan, because the feeling at the HSOC is that there's sort of some misnomers about the homeless community and what the nonprofits are doing or not doing, or what they should do, or what the county is doing and what the county should do. And so we're trying to get sort of a just more of a collaborative regional approach and push those messages out. So anyway, that more to come on that. And there was a pretty significant COVID outbreak at 40 Prado in the last couple of weeks. 50 people had tested positive for COVID there. So that was pretty scary and significant. And County Health has told them to halt all intakes at 40 Prado. There are exceptions to that in regards to people that are experiencing domestic violence or human trafficking. I think just now they're just starting to possibly be able to take people back in. And then also the state is finally moving on the COVID rental relief program. I'm sure you heard that was kind of a program that was well-intended, but unfortunately it took like 5 hours to apply online. So it was kind of a nightmare. So they finally have fixed some of the issues the state has. Five States Homeless Coalition has submitted 88 applications. So that's really good news. And she thinks that Jana from Five States Homeless Coalition is saying that the program, that COVID rental relief program, will probably continue until next year at a minimum. So that's not going to end when the moratorium ends. Some people think that, but they're two separate items. So those are all my updates from and Zone 3 did not meet. So that was it. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Starton.
Great. Thank you, Mayor. In regards to the FCFA, our meeting on the 20th was canceled. For South County Chamber Government Affairs, our next meeting will be this Friday. I did attend the AG business meeting for my turn in August, and they did announce that they're taking applications for leadership class 3, leadership South County. So you can go through the South County Chamber of Commerce for those people that may be interested in applying. And it's a great leadership opportunity for community members that want to engage and learn more about city government, business operations, and sharing a community together. I do have a report on IWMA, and I was asked to give a report at our last meeting, certainly like I normally would, but I wrote down a few things because I think some of the information that has been shared individually is perhaps not accurate. And I think from my perspective as the board member, our representative for the city of AG, I'd like to go through a few things that have put us to where we are now. And I think it'll be helpful information for all of you. As most of people have heard is that the County Board of Supervisors through a majority vote has decided to remove themselves from the county IWMA. And this regional board has been together for over 25 years to confront regional expectations and demands of trash disposal and recycling in our community. And the board consists of our 7 county cities, our 5 county supervisors, and 1 CSD representative. So from my perspective, there's been a number of articles and statements made by people that I feel like don't accurately represent the dedicated efforts of our IWMA board and staff, either historically or even in our present context. The work has done some incredible work over the years. So I wanted to share some of that information so there's an understanding. When I arrived to the IWMA board back in January of 19, we had an interim director, Mr. Giancola. He was our acting interim executive director, and his presence was the result of the potential criminal and civil actions involving the former director and a staff member. Mr. Giancola was in the process of working through some of these difficulties and implemented processes to stabilize and introduce more accountability into the organization. And when I came on board, there was an obvious despair by everybody, county, cities, the CSDs, about what was currently happening with the organization. And it was really important at that time that riding this ship was extremely important. And so together we engaged in multiple processes to not only identify any potential wrongdoing, but also to take measures to identify weaknesses and create policies and practices and procedures to enhance further transparency and confidence and accountability within the organization. I reviewed our agendas over the last 2.5 years, and I wanted to talk briefly about some of the things that the board implemented through some great staff work to make some great changes to the organization. We used to meet every other month, so 6 times a year. We changed those meetings to once a month because I think we recognized the urgency of the situation. We approved a forensic audit of our records in all of our accounts. We reviewed, updated, and created multiple policies to increase security, accountability, and transparency. We approved an annual internal inventory and revenue audits. We created a strategic plan that cost us about $150,000 to provide organizational direction. We hired a permanent director in Mr. Brooks Stayer, who unfortunately resigned a couple of months ago, but he was really imperative in getting us to work on a lot of these objectives and was very helpful for the organization. We implemented contracts with the County of San Luis Obispo Human Resources and the Auditor's Office and their IT department to create consistency in hiring practices, added expense revenue accountability, and creating network capabilities for added security and responsible digital record keeping. Staff was able to complete and we approved an IWMA employee handbook. We hired new positions, and introduced redundancy measures to stop the potential for employee misuse and theft. So those are a lot of the highlights that I was able to pull out of our agendas during our discussions. I'm sure there are others that I missed. But in addition to the defined and purposeful measures that we took by the board, The IWMA staff should be credited along with the contractors that worked with us to provide continued outreach, education, and tend to the day-to-day tasks of the operational expectations of their duties. And they did this in a very professional and respectful way and adjusted well to the serious and important functions that needed to be implemented to help right the ship. I personally, as a member of the board, was bothered by some of the statements that were made at a recent Board of Supervisors meeting, kind of disparaging the IWMA and its staff for faults that involved specific individuals from a distant time and using that experience as a reason to defect from the IWMA. For the last 2.5 years, we have worked together, the county, the cities, and the CSD representative. We were able to create these practices and procedures and form a stronger, a better, and even a more accountable IWMA. Had this dysfunction of the IWMA partnership was a driving factor, the county could have easily pulled out 3 years ago. But instead, and I appreciate, we all chose to work together and made some really great changes to right the organization. So in my opinion, the IWMA in front of us today is not the IWMA that was here 3 years ago. We've had our differences with a few policy decisions, but overall there was a sincere desire to make sure the organization was whole. We'd had to use common sense and practical expectations and citizens' money over the last 2.5 years to implement these policies, make these changes, have a strategic plan. And the current staff was dedicated to make those things happen. So the county has decided to go, but I would submit to all of you that we've had many more successes than we did as failures as an organization. The consultant hired by the county, whose job was to analyze the fiscal impacts of the departure, gave a lot of compelling financial reasons for the city, I'm sorry, for the county not to leave. And even prior to the county's voted departure, the board for the last 2.5 years has approved taxpayer-funded monies to fix and change the organization to make sure that the situation that's being investigated right now will never happen again. So as we're looking, moving forward, the county certainly is looking at millions of dollars in costs should they depart, but it's undetermined how that departure is going to affect our cities and our ratepayers financially at this time as well. Some of the discussion about the departure had to do with the polystyrene ordinance. Some have stated that the issue, that the act of our county creating its own ordinances that haven't been adopted by the state was a driving factor for the county to leave. I've learned in my short stint in politics that you win some and you lose some, but quitting really wasn't the option. Quitting to me undermines the process of our democracy, our ability to work through the differences and create consensus, teamwork, and recognizing those differing opinions is kind of a fundamental truth of who we are. And it's important that it gives us variety in decision-making. And there's many places and people that will never experience that type of opportunity. So I know on my role as the board, as the representative for the city of Rio Grande, I've tried to introduce scenarios over the course of the last few months to come to reasonable solutions for the county not to leave. I've asked that we change our JPA to a form language that would allow for state mandates only. I've talked about revamping our polystyrene ordinance to make it more acceptable for those that perhaps were not agreeable to it. But frankly, there was no overwhelming interest to have discussions of consensus. It also has been mentioned that some of the people that have talked about leaving are worried about a loss of local control. It would be me as a Rio Grande representative have voted to make rules that would be implemented in Paso Robles. So there was concern that they were losing local control. Some of the argument doesn't make a lot of sense because some of the policies that some members of the IWMA wants to happen, they want the state to decide and then tell us how to do it. So in a sense, we are losing that local control by waiting for the state to tell us what to do. So the logic of the argument was hard to follow. Bear with me, I just have a little bit more. I just want to make sure I cover it all. And then there was another concern by some that the IWMA was in the process of creating ordinances like the polystyrene ordinance that had criminal penalties to it. And it was viewed by some as having penalties of a criminal nature would be draconian and out of line. I would ask most of my peers, and all of you are well-versed in ordinances and laws, if you look at every ordinance ever written, most of them have criminal penalties of some sort, some type of criminal liability wording. It's common in most federal, state, and local laws. Our own IWMA has created approximately 8 to 10 ordinances during its last 25 years, which regulate the disposal of paint, fluorescent tubes, batteries, needles, mercury, prescription medication. All of these have criminal liability wording. And even through my own public records request that I did a little over a year ago to each of our member agencies, I was trying to discover how much enforcement was done regarding our ordinances. And in the 25 years, no person or entity has ever been cited, fined, or jailed for noncompliance. And moving forward, I think if we did have a violation, it would have to be pretty significant for those measures to take place, and we'd probably be thankful that the verbiage was there. So I do want to conclude, though, I wish the county well as they choose to depart, but with most things, the sentiment of today will change as decision makers come and go, and I look forward to working with our remaining partners, and that still needs to be discovered who those partners will be. I think for the most part, we have engaged in reasonable discussions, had practical solutions, trying to be fiscally prudent, and building consensus. I think these are all things that our new partners will look forward to. So as we look to action items moving forward, right now we are still in limbo, trying to determine from the county's perspective as to what their expectations are when they leave, what they are obligated for and available to receive should they leave or when they leave, and when is the date that they're going to leave. So that has been asked of them. Our executive board will be meeting, and hopefully we have an answer to some of that information. And once the executive board meets, we'll meet the middle of next month and have further discussions as to the timing of the process for the county's departure and more discussions as to what entities plan to remain as an IWMA. And so there is still some unknown to some of this. So that was some of my, the most of the things that I could think of that I just wanted you to know a little bit of the history and where we are. But quite honestly, it is still in limbo.
So I have a couple questions based on what was said at the mayor's meeting. So first of all, Jan Marks was there not as a city representative, but as the IWMA representative to help facilitate the conversation. And one of the things she said was that Monday, yesterday, the executive committee, I'm not sure whom, was meeting to decide to hire a consultant to help understand the effect of what the monetary effect of the withdrawal. And she cited some, I don't want to say flaws, but that the county's study didn't study what it needed to in order for the IWMA to make decisions. Do you know if they did decide to do that?
No, it hasn't been reported back to the general board. So if there are some decision processes that are being made at the executive level, they'll bring those recommendations back to the board for discussion and potential vote.
Got it. And then she also said that, can't read my own writing, sorry, that I don't recall if this was her or if it was Mayor Martin, because the two of them were going back and forth, but it said that the member agencies that are remaining still have protection under the current JPA, and that the withdrawal, it says specifically in the language that a withdrawing agency gets no assets. And so they said the county may get aggressive. I don't know what that means. I guess we'll find out more later, but I just wanted to, like I said, I didn't want to do this report before Councilmember Storton did. So I'm just reporting out some more of what was said at the mayor's meeting as recently as Friday. They said the county will have to establish their own version of the IWMA in their public works, presumably in their public works division, but it's not there right now. So the cities don't have the opportunity to join them. at this point because they don't have anything at this point. Atascadero seemed to push back a little bit when we were talking about whether cities would continue with the IWMA. I don't know how official that was, but there was some concerns that were very similar to the concerns that Councilmember Storton brought forward about kind of that loss of local control and whether the philosophy that perhaps the IWMA had overstepped in taking the lead on some environmental issues. Let's see here. There was a lot of discussion about 1383, I don't know if I have that right, and SB 619, if it passes, so there's more to come on that. I am certainly not in any position to discuss any of that, and I think it's far beyond what we have here. But I do want to ask Councilmember Storton, I'd like to have a staff report on this, but it's probably too early because we don't even know what's going on. What do you foresee in terms of, you know, agendizing something here so that the whole council can get up to speed and ask their questions and be dealing with, you know, not what's in the newspaper, but what's actually in a staff report?
Right. I think that would be important to have that discussion. It's, I think the timing will be important. I'm hoping by our next meeting in the middle of September, we'll have a little more insight as to some parameters as to a timeline. And I think once we understand a timeline, we'll be able to make some more decisions. Right now, there's a whole scope of issues having to do with 1383, which is organic waste requirements that the state is mandating by all jurisdictions by January of this next year, which is approaching quickly. And so the IWMA's budget is dependent upon funds that come in from our haulers and our ratepayers. And so there's discussions about raising those rates, which enacts a 218 process, which gets a little more complicated with timing. And I know, I'm not going to speak for Whitney, but I know she has been involved in discussions with city managers on this topic. So I think she would be a good resource as to let us know when the best time would be for this to be presented to us.
Sounds good. All right. Well, that was council reports for item 13. So that takes us to, I'm sorry, item 12. So that takes us to item 13, council communications.
Lon needs to do her reports.
Oh, I forgot about you. Oh my gosh. I got so caught up in item
number 14 anyways.
I took so long, sorry.
I'm like, how do I follow that? I just wanted to take a moment just to thank Councilmember Storton. That was an extremely thoughtful report out, and I know that took you a lot of time to go through and research all of that data and provide that for us. And I'm just grateful that you're the one that's representing Rio Grande at the IWMA, and I have full faith in your leadership there. So thank you very much for that report. Mine is very short. CAPSLO met, and CAPSLO is just a great meeting to attend because we're very non-controversial and everything is just how much money we get and where we get to, you know, spend it. And I think that in light of all the other reports we hear all the time, this is just one that it's a meeting I always enjoy attending. So report out for CAPSLO, we received $1.4 million in ARPA funding to assist with utility payments for those who need help with utility payments. And that'll be running from now through March of 2023. We received $263,000 in low income weatherization funding. So 40 Prada will be getting solar panels because of that grant. We received $631,000 in grant funding to assist our veteran families with partial rent. So if they're struggling with rent for the next 2 years, we'll be able to supplement their rent with that $631,000. 40 Prado is the homeless center right next door. 34 Prado is the medically assisted treatment facility that received a certificate of occupancy. They had their ribbon cutting I think it was like last Thursday. So they're really excited that that facility is up and running and fully funded and operational. And RAC meets next week, and my other two committees don't meet for a while. So those are my report outs.
You're not forgotten, Councilmember George. I promise. My brain, I was so done with IWMA.
It was a lot. That was a lot of information to take in.
All right. So thank you. And this does take us to Council Communications. So does anybody have anything to share? Oh, yay, Councilmember Barnidge.
I have two just quick things. Empty Bowls tickets are now on sale. You can go to the 5CHC website and buy those. There's a couple different dates, and I think Lawn is going to be a bowl helper. Different dates, different locations, so get those while you can. Also, there was the same person that was concerned about the watering for the ag brought up a plant that I think should be mentioned for people that are interested in a lawn-like look, but not lawn. So it's a turf. It's a turf alternative, and it's called Carapia, and it's spelled Kurapia. And it's actually gorgeous, and it has little white flowers, and it kind of looks like a lawn, not exactly, but it's incredible because it's green all year and you only have to water it once a month, maybe in the summer. You don't have to water it all year and you mow it once a month. So I'm going to go take a look at it because it's at his property in AG. But if anybody's looking for something that looks like sod, that's not sod, that takes almost no water, message me or give me a call. So anyway, it's a really pretty plant. And that's all I have. Thank you.
Any other council reports? Councilmember Barnidge, consider this your message. I just Googled it really fast. It looks beautiful. I've never heard of it. So let me know what you think. All right, everyone. So that is item 13. That takes us to item 14, closed session. We already did that. So item 15 is adjournment, and we will adjourn and look forward to the next meeting, which will be all about water. So, all right, everyone, stay safe, stay healthy. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thank you. Good night.